So I was sitting over here and I started listening to this table laughing and I got FOMA. Y'all all know what FOMA is, right? Fear of missing out. I'm like, we're over here talking about books and what we've been reading and they're about falling out of their chairs laughing. So you'll have to enlighten us later. So anyway, Pastor Eric, like Sarah was saying, kicked us off the series Speaking on Godliness. And Paul tells us that godliness with contentment is great gain. So I like the fact that we're kind of bookending these sessions. We started with godliness and we're ending with contentment. We set these topics back in November of last year, and I felt the Lord putting it on my heart to take this one. And then in December, I started having stress dreams over it. I'm sure the fact that we had 7 kids home for the holidays did not help. And I had the same dream twice. So in this dream, it's the Titus Women series, but we're up in the Sunday school setting, and there are men and women in there, and I'm sitting there thinking, why am I talking to men? I do not want to be doing this. I am not comfortable speaking to these men. And then I realized all I had planned were my introductory remarks. I had nothing left to share after I did my introduction, and Hanny's sitting there and I'm hissing at him going, you're going to have to get up and do this. And he's like, what? And I'm like, I'm not prepared. You're going to have to get up and do it. And when we were at our former church, Hanny had to preach one Sunday the whole time we were there, and he spoke on contentment. So I'm like, you got this. You know this. So in the dream, he begrudgingly, not very happily, gets up to do it. He is a good man. And then at that point, I woke up and was like, phew, but I better start studying. So anyway, here we are tonight, and I did manage to come up with some notes on the topic. That's good. Paul tells us in Philippians 4 that he has learned the secret of being content. So I wanted to speak to contentment because, like Paul, I've learned that secret. That's a joke. In fact, I would say that this is something I continue to struggle with, and if we're all honest, we probably all struggle with it. I think it's just universal. We struggle being content with the hand that God has dealt us, just the circumstances going on in our lives. So, and I would say for me, these past 5 years since our last 2 children left home has been a time when I've wrestled with this a lot. Maybe I would call it the winter of my discontent. You know, as moms, we pour out our lives into the lives of our children, and then one day they're all gone. The home is empty. My identity, I came to see, had been greatly wrapped up in my children. You know, the swim team, carpools, the homeschooling, their successes kind of become our successes. So now what? So this really caught me as a surprise. Hanny and I still had a good marriage. You know, nothing wrong there. But I was not content. I found myself being just discontent with the state of my life. So I think it's a good topic for us to look at because Paul says that it's great gain to have contentment. So shouldn't we all want this for ourselves? So I've heard it said that all work and no plagiarism makes a dull message. So right off the bat, I wanted to share my sources. So this is a Table Talk magazine, 20 years old. Yes, I'm a hoarder. Maybe I need to go to a 12-step program. Say, my name is Kathy. I'm a hoarder. So when I even swipe the title, The Rare Jewel of Contentment. And then my other source is The Secret of Contentment, and he just wrote from one of the Puritan writers who was Jeremy Burroughs. He brought it up to modern day language so that we can understand it. But notice the proverbial glass on the cover. Is it half full or is it half empty? So I drew a lot from those. So Burroughs, the writer of the book, defines Christian contentment as that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. Noah Webster defines it as resting or satisfaction of mind without disquiet. Happy enough with what one has or is, not desiring something more or different. So how many of you would raise your hands here tonight and say, I am perfectly content? I am happy with what I have. I want nothing more. So I think of King David, and one rendering of the 23rd Psalm says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I lack for nothing." In Philippians 4 through 13, now I'm going to read the verses, Paul states, "I rejoiced in the Lord greatly, that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. Not that I am speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty, hunger, abundance, and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me." And so as I read this, I was struck by Paul's firmness of faith. I know how to be brought low. I know how to abound. I can do all things. It was good. So the idea Paul is trying to get across is that our contentment is not determined by outward circumstances. And that's a good thing, don't you think? We can be in trying circumstances as determined by God for long periods of time. I think of my daughter Anna, who is now turning 23, and her back problem started when she was 14. And we still haven't seen a complete resolution of that. So we can be in periods like this for a long time. How many of you would say that there's something you've been praying for, wanting God to do for a while? I can raise my hand. Do you find yourself in a state of contentment even when you don't see your circumstances shift? If I'm honest, my emotions are constantly in a state of flux, often having to do, or I'd say most of the time having to do with my circumstances. I can remember going through a day just feeling so, you know, just kind of blah, and just one of those days. And I get home and get a phone call from a child, some great news, and all of a sudden, presto, my whole day has changed. And I'm thinking, that should not be. What's changed? God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. He's not changed. My circumstances had changed. But isn't that a worldly, temporal thing? So is that the sort of Christians we want to be? Am I glorifying God when I'm so dependent on my circumstances rather than dependent on him who has promised to never leave us or forsake us? The best that the world has to offer cannot compare to what we've inherited in Christ. And so we become a slave to our circumstances when we live like that. Contrast that to Paul, whose contentment was not based on what was happening in his life. He is saying in any and every circumstance, and then you know Paul's story, you know all of his circumstances, lashes and shipwrecked and I think wild animals and stuff, and most of us have not been through really any of that. But Paul recognized and understood that every situation, I think this is key, that he encountered came from the hand of God. So we want to grow in being aware of God's providence and recognize that God has ordained all things for our good and for his glory. I have a great note in my study Bible on the providence of God. The first part of it is from the Westminster Shorter Catechism. God's work of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful preserving and governing all his creatures and all their actions. And then the note goes on to say, if creation was a unique exercise of divine energy causing the world to be, providence is a continued exercise of that same energy. By it, the Creator, according to his own will, keeps all creatures in being, involves himself in all events, and directs all things to their appointed end. So whatever you're going on, whatever is going on in your life, God's directing that to its appointed end. God is completely in charge of his world. His hand may be hidden, but his perfect rule extends to all things. So the doctrine of providence teaches Christians that they are never in the grip of blind fortune, chance, luck, or fate. Isn't that good? All that happens to them is divinely planned, and each event comes as a new summons to trust, obey, and rejoice, knowing that all is for one's spiritual and eternal good. And because our circumstances come from God's hands, we can joyfully submit to them. So the type of contentment described in Philippians 4 reflects God's self-sufficiency. God, as you know, is not dependent on anyone, nor does he need anything outside of himself. He is fully self-sufficient. So obviously there's a difference between God and us. He's the creator. We are his creatures. We are dependent on him. We're actually dependent on others. I'm standing here tonight because others have been praying for me today. And we're dependent on certain aspects of God's creation for survival, for him to keep things going. Yet, to the extent that we achieve the self-sufficiency described by Paul, we reflect in a small way this one aspect of the character of God. Think about that. In other words, as we become content, or rather self-sufficient in him, then God is glorified in our lives. John Piper has said that God is most glorified when we are satisfied in him. And then here's another quote, and this is from Socrates. Contentment is natural wealth. Luxury is artificial poverty. So how many of you would say that immorality is sin? You're not going to think about going out and committing adultery with your neighbor's husband, right? Hope not. How about idolatry, to bow down and worship the graven images like they had in the Old Testament? No, most of us wouldn't think about that. Let me ask you this. How do you feel about murmuring and complaining? The Puritans were wont to say that discontent or complaining was a serious sin. Is that the way we feel today? So another verse in Philippians tells us to do all things without grumbling and questioning. Think about it. At the root of it, we're complaining against who? God. And Eric talks about this a lot, and C.S. Lewis wrote about it. We're putting God in the dock, really, when we do that. We're putting God on trial. And I, by nature, as I said starting out, I'm not always a contented person. And I hate to admit it, but I can really grumble and complain. So forget everything Sarah said. But as I was preparing this, I recalled a time I was in sixth grade, so very young, and a friend, pretty good friend, invited me to go to her lake house for the weekend, and it was a couple hours away. She was already, though, down at the lake, so I was to drive to the lake with her dad, whom I really didn't know very well. So I'm just dropped off at her house to meet up with this dad, and there's this other sixth grade girl that's shown up. I don't know this girl, and she's also been invited to the lake, Allison. She went to a different elementary school, and I was not happy with this situation one bit. I thought it was just going to be Sally and me, you know, unfulfilled expectations on my part. That's one of Hanny's favorite quotes. And now I had to share Sally with this other girl. And as you all know, three can be a crowd, especially for 11-year-old girls. And it's too late to back out. I'm dropped off, and here I go with this dad and this girl I don't know. And I'm, so I haven't even arrived at the lake house, and I'm already just feeling put out over the situation. It was not going to my liking. I don't know why, but I was always invited to go off with families for a week or so, and I was not always the best guest. Their family just never measured up to how fun my family was. Just nothing was good enough. So I don't know why I always got invited. But in my mind, it just was not quite as good. So I'm sure I'm grumbling and complaining. Nothing was to my liking. Their lake was small. And it really was small compared to where we would go. And the water was choppy. for skiing, and I was just letting everyone know of my dissatisfaction. And I didn't even realize I was doing this. At age 11, one is not always the most self-aware. Heck, at whatever age I am now, we're not always the most self-aware. But finally, this dad, who I didn't know very well, looks at me, and we're out on a sailboat, so I'm trapped now. He goes, "Do you ever do anything but complain?" Oh. Yeah, really. He's a psychologist. Ouch. He probably should not have called me out like that in front of the other two girls. You know, if he had had wisdom, he probably would have, in a gentle way, maybe pulled me aside. But the truth of his words stung, and in my 11-year-old heart, I knew he was right. I could see the truth of his words, and I was embarrassed over my behavior, mortified at being called out like that. So I was probably the guest they never wanted to have back, and Allison was the perfect little guest. By the way, this family had 7 children of their own, so why in the world they wanted 2 more of us? I don't know. The only redeeming thing was when Dr. Jones returned us to our hometown, on the way there, Allison got car sick, and he had to pull over, and she emptied her stomach right there on the highway. The carnival rides from the night before had not agreed with her. So at least I did not have to add that to my list of sins. So that's kind of a funny little story, but listen to the passage from Numbers 11. "And the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp." Whew, I'm glad God doesn't do that every time I complain. So grumbling entails forgetting God's presence and his blessing in our lives. Secondly, discontent typically involves exaggerating the past, you know, the good old days. Remember the Israelites crying out to Moses, "Oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our strength is dried up." Any of y'all remember Keith Green? Anybody ever hear that song, "So You Want to Go Back to Egypt"? So you want to go back to Egypt, where it's warm and secure. Are you sorry you bought the one-way ticket when you thought you were sure? You wanted to live in the land of promise, but now it's getting so hard. Are you sorry you're out here in the desert instead of your own backyard, eating leeks and onions by the Nile? Ooh, what breath for dining out in style. Ooh, my life's on the skids, building the pyramids. Well, there's nothing to do but travel, and we sure travel a lot, because it's hard keeping your feet from moving when the sand gets so hot. And in the morning, it's manna hotcakes. We snack on manna all day. And we sure had a winner last night for dinner, flaming manna souffle. Claudia, I think we should have had manna tonight. But you get the general idea there. So the Israelites, remembering Egypt fondly, was not only false, it was an offense to God, who had graciously and how miraculously delivered them. And I had found myself doing that over the last 5 years. Oh, if only I were still homeschooling and had all the kids around me. Now, those were the good old days, you know, co-op and all the sunlight books we got to read. Really, it's not being content with the current season of our life where God has us. And when we grumble, we don't believe God's in control. We question his ability to make good on his promises. At the root of it, then, really is a lack of faith. How often do we as adults complain just like those Israelites? One of the damning lies of our generation today is that we should have no unfulfilled needs. The commercials all tell you that. You should never have anything unfulfilled. No unfulfilled wants. So going back to the 23rd Psalm, who among us feels like that they have everything they need? How many of you have gone to your quiet time this week simply worshiping him as your king and your Lord and said, "Lord, you are enough. I have need of nothing else because I have you. Honestly, sometimes when I think about it, I feel like such a brat. I can go through some days just feeling so discontent. Really? I have a wonderful husband. He's not perfect, but he's a godly man. What you all see of Hanny at church, it's real. I mean, I have 5 kids that are all doing relatively well. Again, their lives aren't perfect. There's areas of sanctification I would like to see there. But then Christ always points me back to my own life and says, get the board out of your own life. They say you're only as happy as your least happy child. Well, as a Christian, I would say we cannot live like that. And I have 5 kids, so my life would be abysmal if that were true. Eric once preached a message, and he talked about how we think there's that one thing. If only that one thing would happen, and you can fill in the blank. If only my husband were blah, blah, blah. If only my kids would blah, blah, blah. But it's funny. Has God ever done that one thing in your life? Then you're on to the next thing. Well, but I know that. But Lord, if you only did this. So then we find ourselves thinking we need something else again. So do you see the trap in this? Then we never end up being content. We're never ending up being satisfied. So one note, though, I will say about complaining. You often see the psalmists, the writers of the Psalms, pouring out, you know, his heart, their hearts to God. And I think it's one thing to bring our complaints and our laments to God. I think that's legitimate. But we shouldn't be sitting around just griping to one another all the time. So I've never thought about it quite in these terms. But a contented spirit is a worshipful spirit. Burroughs, the Puritan writer, which this book was based on, states that worship is not only doing what pleases God, but also, listen to this, being pleased with what God does. Worship means finding delight in God. But we find delight in Him only when we are pleased with His sovereign control over our lives. When we are unsettled, restless, anxious, we cannot truly delight in God's presence. We need to submit ourselves to His wiser determination for our lives. He's all wise. We're not. I had this little story I wanted to read. So it's about a monk named Brother John. Brother John entered the Monastery of Silence, and the abbot said, "Brother, this is your silent monastery. You are welcome here as long as you like, but you may not speak until I direct you to do so." Brother John lived in the monastery for 5 years before the abbot said to him, "Brother John, you have been here 5 years now. You may speak 2 words." Brother John said, "Hard bed." "I'm sorry to hear that," the abbot said. "We will get you a better bed." After another 5 years, Brother John was called by the abbot. "You may say another 2 words, Brother John." "Cold food," said Brother John, and the abbot assured him that the food would be better in the future. On his 15th anniversary at the monastery, the abbot again called Brother John into his office. "2 words you may say today." "I quit," said Brother John. To this, the abbot replied, "It's probably best. You've done nothing but complain since you got here." That's cute, isn't it? But back to Philippians 2, the whole passage says, "Do all things without grumbling or questioning, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish, in the world of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain." Murmuring is beneath the dignity of the children of God. all the riches of God's mercy and blessing are available to us. This should give to us a composure that does not mark unbelievers. And the Lord has been convicting me of my conversation at work. Sometimes it involves complaining, and sometimes that's complaining. I'm complaining about other coworkers, people I work with. So now I'm also adding Claudia's sin of a judgmental, critical spirit. And grumbling, not Claudia's sin, you know what I mean. And actually, when we were in our committee talking about the grumbling and critical spirit, we were all raising our hands saying, I could speak on that. No, I'll speak on that. We all were kind of vying for that one. But in grumbling, seriously, we assert self and we fail to submit to God's rule over us. So we often take too narrow a view of this world, of life in this world. So we need a broader vision of all that God has done and is doing for us. John Newton, remember him? He's the slave trader and turned hymn writer, writes, suppose a man was going to York, he lived in England, to take possession of a large estate, and his carriage should break down a mile before he got to the city, which obliged him to walk the rest of the way. So 1 mile. What a fool we should think him if we saw him wringing his hands and blubbering out of the all the way in the remaining mile. My chaise is broken. My chaise is broken. In the same way, why should we grumble and complain at the momentary troubles and afflictions of this life when God has given all things to us? The concerns of this world are nothing compared to the inheritance laid up for God's saints. So to be well skilled in the mystery, the rare jewel of Christian contentment, is the duty, glory, and excellence of a Christian. The end.